Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, who is dedicating this Labor Day weekend show to our final installment of Beach Reads. Since we've delved deeply into the spy PI thriller genre recently, we'll go a little more touchy-feely with this episode. Now stay with us, guys. It's not all chick lit. I've included entertaining titles for all in the mix, so stay tuned as we turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Books and his radio essays for NPR's This American Life, David Rakoff built a reputation as one of our finest and funniest essayists. Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish is his intricately woven novel, written with humor, sympathy, and tenderness. And it's written in verse. Rakoff, who passed away a year ago, sang the song of an America whose freedoms can be intoxicating or brutal. The characters' lives are linked to one another by acts of generosity or cruelty. A hobo offers unexpected refuge on the rails during the Great Depression. An office girl endures the casually vicious sexism of the 1950s. A young man revels in the electrifying sexual and artistic openness of 1960s San Francisco, then later tends to dying friends and lovers as AIDS devastates his community. Rakoff's insistence on beauty and the necessity of kindness in a selfish world elevates this novel to must-read status. And you will so enjoy Rakoff's narration.
Drink in some men is a beautiful thing. Sweet Eamon Dolan finds courage to sing. Shy William Thomas will realize he's handsome, but Frank holds them prisoner without any ransom. Who are you talking to? What was his name? Do take me for daft. Every night was the same. Her mother would wash while she dried the dishes. Frankie would pace the room angry, suspicious. Occasionally, some glass or plate would be broken. Those were the lucky nights, crockery as token. Some mornings her mother used powder for masking a shiner. But soon all the girls just stopped asking. The threats go for hours. At long last he ceases, and stumbling half-blind in his boozy paresis, he crosses the room and falls into the bed. Nearby Margaret prays, "Dear God, please make Frank dead." At 12 Margaret grew quite suddenly bigger and showed the beginnings of womanly figure. The old shirt waists that had once fit her just right had, in the wrong places, become just too tight. Clinging and gaping where once they had hung, her mother was frightened. Sure, Peg's just too young. The garment's constriction confirming her fear, though younger than Juliet's 14 by 2 years, the Romeos, pomaded, would soon come a-knocking, cockaded, parading. Too true, though still shocking, her Margaret gave off a narcotic allure. Just how might she manage to keep her girl pure? She tried as she could to conceal Margaret when they had to walk past all the slaughter floor men. Each walk across the floor was a dance of avoiding the puddles of blood and the catcalls of, "Hoyden, why all are you rushing? Stay back, you got time. My meat's not a rib, but it's certainly prime." Each insult occasioned a new gale of laughs. They toasted each other by knocking their gaffs together like musketeers crossing their swords, knee-deep in carrion, but feeling like lords. That red hair, that figure, had adult men sputtering a wordless desire, or else they'd be muttering, dark boasts which a harsh glance could usually halt, but the theme of it all was that Peg was at fault. That she had incited the wolfish responses, this siren so stuck up and selfish, who had no right acting so shy and so prim. You'd think she had diamonds all up in that. "I'll have you remember that girl is my daughter," her mother would yell, but the men of the slaughterhouse would only be goaded to further chest pounding, barbaric in keeping with their vile surroundings. The drain in the floor, a near useless feature, meant to dispatch all the blood of the creatures, but gobbets of scarlet-black visceral scraps routinely stopped them up, clogging the traps. Above them, hog carcasses splayed open, red, like empty, ribbed meat overcoats overhead.
We've just heard Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish by David Rakoff. Claire Cook wrote her first novel at age 45. 5 years later, she walked the red carpet on the Hollywood premiere of the adaptation of her second novel, Must Love Dogs. She's now the best-selling author of 10 novels, including Wallflower in Bloom and her latest, Time Flies. Claire was born in Virginia, taught school for 16 years, lived in New England, and now lives near Atlanta. Her books have been translated into 14 languages, and they are delightful. Welcome, Claire. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm a fan.
I want to congratulate you for what I think is one of the best first lines ever. And I quote, "When my cell phone rang, I just finished cutting up my marriage mattress."
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it. I think you're kind of in or out with that one.
In your bio, you share you wrote your first novel in a minivan. Strange choice for an office. What happened?
Well, being a novelist was something I wanted to do my whole life, and I just kind of chickened out and listened to everybody's negativity, you know, everyone telling me you need connections, it's, you know, how hard it is to get published and all of that, which is true, not the connections part, but how hard it is. And I just kind of let decades go by, never going after this lifelong dream. And so, you know, fast forward, 45 is on the horizon, and I was sitting outside my daughter's swim practice in my minivan, and it just kind of hit me like a ton of bricks that, you know, I could live my whole life and not even try. So I was a teacher. I consulted for a couple other schools. I was just busy, busy, busy. And my only available time was 5 mornings a week at 5:30 in the morning as my daughter swam. So I wrote a whole book like that.
Wow, that's very inspirational for other women who are thinking about it. Introduce us to Melanie, the central character in Time Flies.
Melanie, you know, I think that Melanie is someone who her husband dragged her kind of kicking and screaming in her whole happy little family to follow him when he had a promotion. And she became a metal sculptor and kind of, you know, found her way through her art and everything, you know, life came together, her kids grew up well, everything was good, and then her husband left her for another woman. So I think the story, Time Flies and Melanie's story is lifelong friendship, what sustains you, and also just how many fun things and what a wonderful life is on the horizon if you can only get through your, you know, all the obstacles kind of standing between where you are right now and where you want to go, which I think is absolutely the theme of my novels as well as my life.
So music plays such a huge part in the book. To me, it almost felt like there was a 16-year-old girl trapped inside of Melanie, and it was the music that let her out.
Oh, that's so cool that you said that. I so believe that for all of us. I think that those old songs just bring it all back, and I think there's a little bit, in all of us, I believe there's kind of that 16-year-old who's trapped inside wondering if anyone's going to ask her to dance, you know? So strolling down the memory lane with the music was just so much fun for me, and readers have really been responding to that. And everyone keeps wanting to buy the playlist, but unfortunately, you have to download them individually.
All right. You wrote in the book, there are only two choices in life, afraid and boring. Tell us more about that.
You know, I believe that for the longest time, I thought other people were not afraid. But the truth is, you know, even right now, it's like, you know, am I going to do a good job in this interview? I mean, that is every single day since I've, you know, and I'm 10 novels in now. I think that it's really easy to think that other people aren't afraid. But if we're doing something interesting and challenging, and if we're moving forward in our lives, we're afraid, or we're just sitting around twiddling our thumbs, being bored. So even though it was Melanie's dream, I think, when that line came up, it was very much, I just believe it. And I have met so many women since my first book came out who just, you know, really need to hear this message, and I'm so happy to be able to, you know, get it out there in a fun way.
You know, I was interested that in the book, Melanie had very serious problems with her sister. Why was this conflict central to the story?
You know, I think with number one, I think it's really, it was such a discovery for me to find out that other people have dysfunctional families too. I mean, wouldn't you think we'd all realize that, but it always, and not to say, I mean, I have four wonderful sisters and none of them are, you know, in the book, I have to say, but, you know, we all know that family stuff. And I also think that, you know, I write fun beach books, books you take on vacation, but there also has to be an underpinning of serious, because I think our lives are that way. You're having a blast one minute, and then the phone rings or something happens. So, you know, Melanie needed to work through her sister stuff because, you know, nobody loves you like a sister, or but also no one drives you crazier, and sometimes the change is minute to minute. So I just felt like one of the reasons I write is to help readers see themselves and, you know, their own families. I always get the, oh, my God, you're writing my life. And I just think it's a part of it for all of us.
Oh, yeah. Crazy sister. Are you listening, Norma? That's my sister. Well, I loved Melanie's relationship with her best friend, BJ. Were there any best friend road trips or films that influenced you?
Oh, absolutely, Lynn, absolutely. You know what? I came into this book wanting to do a lot of things, but one of them was I love the girlfriend movies, you know, Thelma and Louise and Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. And I kind of wanted, and I don't think it really came out that way, but I wanted to write a boomer twist on Romy and Michelle's high school reunion when you've got so much baggage, you just can't slide into a miniskirt and jump into a convertible and take off. There's just all this other stuff in your life, and yet you can still have, there is nothing like a road trip with an old friend, you know, or that kind of fun thing. You can still do it, you know, and so I think it's the, you know, it's never too late. It's too late to paraphrase George Eliot. It really isn't.
Well, you say you get a lot of inspiration for your books from eavesdropping. So what have you overheard lately?
Oh, well, you know, now it's gone beyond eavesdropping. It used to be that if we were at a restaurant together, I'd be, or at the same restaurant, I'd be listening to the conversation at your table. But now it's all, I've brought it out to Facebook and Twitter, so I really don't even have to eavesdrop. I just have to ask. And I asked with Time Flies, what song most reminds you of high school? And in like minutes, I had hundreds and hundreds of answers. And it was, you know, kind of a four-decade range. And it was amazing which songs repeated. So, you know, I'm just always listening. And but I have to say, social networking has changed things. I'm able to ask my readers directly, you know, what should I write about next? You know, what did you overhear that was really interesting? And believe me, they did.
All right. Well, are you already working on your new title?
I am. I am. I actually, because I've been doing a book a year for a while now, which I'm lucky enough to be able to be a full-time writer, so I can do that. So I delivered to my literary agent a draft of my next novel right as Time Flies came out in June. So, yeah, I'm kind of on my way. I'm always a little superstitious maybe about talking about it too soon because so much changes during the editorial process. So I'm always afraid if I say this is happening, suddenly it's not. But it's very much, I've, for the first time, which after 10 books, I'm deciding to turn one of my earlier books into a series, which I've never done, and it's such a fun challenge for me. So that's the plan, and, you know, sometime in 2014, we'll all know more.
All right. Is there a working title for this book?
Well, I can tell you that it's Must Love Dogs that I'm turning into a series, which people have asked me, thousands of people have asked me since it first came out. So revisiting those characters, who are probably the characters I know the most. So somehow that will be in there. It will be Must Love Dogs something. But it was just so much fun to, you know, having learned as much as I've learned in the books that have come between then and now, and then to revisit it. And it's just been such a really, really fun challenge. And so that's all I know so far.
Well, we'll certainly be on the lookout. I loved Time Flies, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, and I love all your interviews. You're so good. So thank you so much for having me. You really are.
All right. Thanks, Claire.
Take care.
All right. Bye. Now, let's hear a sampling of Time Flies, narrated by Lisa Cook.
When my cell phone rang, I'd just finished cutting up my marriage mattress. I put down my chainsaw carefully so it wouldn't scratch the hardwood floor. Then I slid my safety glasses up to the top of my head, like a headband, and reached for my phone. "Hello," I said.
"Hey," BJ said. "It's me. What's up?"
I puffed a sprinkling of sawdust from the phone. "Not much. Same old, same old."
"So, check your email. The invitation just went out. You are coming up for the reunion, right?"
"No way." When I shook my head for emphasis, more sawdust flaked from my hair like dandruff. "Come on, BJ. We've been over this at least 8 times already."
BJ blew a raspberry into the phone line. "No way" is not an acceptable answer. "You're going. No excuses. You're not still mooning around about Kurt, are you?"
"You mean like counting the days till he sends me a Hallmark card for almost ex-wife's day?"
BJ still laughed exactly like she had in high school, a series of sharp staccato barks.
"See, your sense of humor is back."
"Ha," I said. "What you need is some fun in the sun. Plus, if you ask me, there aren't nearly enough opportunities to act like a teenager once you get to be our age. So we've got to grab any chance we get. And the good news is we can drink legally this time around."
"Great," I said. "But I'm still not going."
"Jan wants all of us to stay at her beach house for the week."
"Jan who?"
"Don't give me Jan who. Jan Siskin. Actually, I think it's Reeves now. Or maybe it was Reeves, but now it's Schroff. Or maybe it's Siskin again. Who cares? Anyway, as you well remember, we kind of hung out with her all 4 years in high school, and now she has a beach house."
"I don't think she really even liked me," I said.
BJ aimed a blast of air across 7 states and into my ear. "Hey, you haven't heard from Veronica, have you?"
I sighed. "You mean in this millennium?"
"She's not returning my phone calls or emails. But she will." I let BJ's tenacity wash over me like a wave. When I looked down, I saw that my non-cell phone holding palm was open, face up, as if to emphasize my own uncertainty. BJ was still talking.
"So you know how I'm on the committee, right? Well, we've decided we're not going to mention either the year we graduated or how many years it's been. We're just going to call it the Marshbury High School Best Class, Best Reunion Ever."
"That's ridiculous."
I opened one of the French doors to the deck off the master bedroom to get rid of the gasoline smell. I seriously needed to upgrade to a battery-operated chainsaw. "The committee consensus is that the actual numbers might be a turnoff. It's a lot of years to wrap your brain around, and none of us feels that old, and most of us don't look that old, especially the women. So we just thought it would be more fun if we focused on the positive."
"Which would be?"
BJ let out a little snort. "That we're still alive." I took a quick stab at the math, then gave up.
"How many years has it been, anyway?"
"Don't even think about it," BJ said. "It's way too depressing. Come on, we haven't seen each other in forever."
"Okay,"
So how about you go to the reunion, and then you can fly down here and tell me all about it.
Mel, I'm serious.
Me too. I'm seriously not going, BJ, so drop it. Please. Give me one good reason you shouldn't go.
I sighed.
Everyone else will dress better, look better, be better than I am. High school reunions are like a test for personal success, and I'll slide right off the bell curve.
I'm not famous, I didn't turn into a knockout, my husband left me, and I stopped wearing heels years ago, and now my feet will only tolerate work boots and flip-flops.
One good reason, BJ said.
I'm still waiting. After we hung up, I put my cell phone down and contemplated the savage chunks of king-size bed before me. It's not that I was bitter. I mostly just wanted the springs.
That was Time Flies by Claire Cook. Curtis Sittenfeld returns with Sisterland, her mesmerizing novel of family and identity, loyalty and deception. And yes, Curtis is a woman. From an early age, Kate and her identical twin, Violet, knew they were a bit different. They had psychic abilities about future events and other people's secrets. Though Vi embraced her visions, Kate did her best to hide them. Now in adulthood, Vi has pursued an eccentric career as a psychic medium, while Kate, a devoted wife and mom, has settled down in the burbs to raise her kids. But when a minor earthquake hits, the normal life Kate always wished for begins to shift. As the date of the predicted earthquake quickly approaches, Kate is forced to reconcile her fraught relationship with her sister and truths about herself she's long tried to deny. Funny, haunting, and thought-provoking, Sisterland is a novel about obligations we have towards others and the responsibility we take for ourselves. Rebecca Lohman narrates.
The shaking started around 3 a.m, and it happened that I was already awake because I'd nursed Owen at 2, and then, instead of going back to sleep, I'd lain there, brooding about the fight I'd had at lunch with my sister Vi. I'd driven with Owen and Rosie in the back seat to pick up Vi, and the four of us had gone to Hacienda. We'd finished eating, and I was collecting Rosie's stray food from the tabletop. Once I had imagined I wouldn't be the kind of mother who ordered chicken tenders for her child off the menu at a Mexican restaurant, when Vi said, "So, I have a date tomorrow." "That's great," I said. "Who is it?" Casually, after running the tip of her tongue over her top teeth to check for food, Vi said, "She's an IT consultant, which sounds boring, but she's traveled a lot in South and Central America, so she couldn't be a total snooze, right?" I was being baited, but I tried to match Vi's casual tone as I said, "Did you meet online?" Rosie, who was 2.5, had gotten up from the table, wandered over to a ficus plant in the corner, and was smelling the leaves. Beside me in the booth, buckled into his car seat, Owen, who was 6 months, grabbed at a little plush giraffe that hung from the car seat's handle. Vi nodded. "There's pretty slim pickings for dykes in St. Louis." "So that's what you consider yourself these days?" I leaned in and said in a lower tone, "A lesbian?" Looking amused, Vi imitated my inclined posture and quiet voice. "At this point, I'm bi-celibate. Or should I say bi-sexual? But I figure it's all a numbers game. I keep putting myself out there, and eventually, I cross paths with Ms. or Mr. Wright." "Meaning you're on straight dating sites, too?" "Not at the moment, but in the future, maybe." Our waitress approached and left the bill at the edge of the table. I reached for it as soon as she'd walked away. When Vi and I ate together, I always paid without discussion. And Vi said, "Don't leave a big tip. She was giving us attitude." I didn't notice. "And my fajita was mostly peppers." "You, of all people, should realize that's not the waitress's fault." For years, all through our 20s, Vi had worked at restaurants. But she was still regarding me skeptically as I set down my credit card, and I added, It's rude not to tip extra when you bring little kids. We were at a conversational crossroads. Either we could stand, I could gather the mess of belongings that accompanied me wherever I went. Once, I had been so organized that I kept my spice rack alphabetized, and now I left hats and bibs and sippy cups in my wake, baggies of Cheerios, my own wallet and sunglasses. And the four of us could head out to the parking lot and then go on to drop Vi at her house, all amicably. Or I could express a sentiment that wasn't Vi, in her way, asking me to share.
That was Sisterland by Curtis Sittenfeld. Maggie O'Farrell's beguiling novels blend textured psychological drama with suspense. Instructions for a Heatwave tracks a family crisis set during the legendary British heatwave of 1976. Greta Reardon wakes on a stultifying July morning to find her husband of 40 years has gone to get the paper and vanished, cleaning out his bank account along the way. Greta's three grown children converge on their parents' home for the first time in years, and each brings with them significant emotional baggage. O'Farrell writes with grace and sensitivity about secrets we hide from the people who know and love us best. John Lee performs the book.
The heat. It wakes Greta just after dawn, propelling her from the bed and down the stairs. It inhabits the house like a guest who has outstayed his welcome. It lies along corridors, it circles around curtains, it lolls heavily on sofas and chairs. The air in the kitchen is like a solid entity filling the space, pushing Greta down into the floor, against the side of the table. Only she would choose to bake bread in such weather. Consider her now, yanking open the oven and grimacing in its scorching blast as she pulls out the bread tin. She is in her nightdress, hair still wound onto curlers. She takes two steps backwards and tips the steaming loaf into the sink, the weight of it reminding her, as it always does, of a baby, a newborn, the packed, damp warmth of it. She has made soda bread three times a week for her entire married life. She is not about to let a little thing like a heat wave get in the way of that. Of course, living in London, it is impossible to get buttermilk. She has to make do with a mixture of half milk and half yogurt. A woman at Mass told her it worked, and it does, up to a point. But it is never quite the same. At a clacking sound on the lino behind her, she says, "Is that you? Bread's ready." "It's going to be..." He begins, then stops. Greta waits for a moment before turning around. Robert is standing between the sink and the table, his large hands upturned, as if he's holding a tea tray. He is staring at something. The tarnished chrome of the tap, perhaps, the runnels of the draining board, that rusting enamel pan. Everything around them is so familiar it's impossible sometimes to tell what your eye has been trained upon, the way a person can no longer hear the individual notes of a known piece of music. "It's going to be a what?" she demands. He doesn't reply. She moves towards him and places a palm on his shoulder. "You are right." She has of late been finding herself reminded of his age, the sudden stoop of his back, the look of mild confusion on his face. "What?" He swings his head around to look at her, as if startled by her touch. "Yes," he nods. "Of course. I was just saying it's going to be another hot one today." He shuffles sideways, just as she'd known he would, towards the thermometer, which clings by a spit-moistened sucker to the outside of the window. It is the third month of the drought. For 10 days now the heat has passed 90 degrees Fahrenheit. There has been no rain, not for days, not for weeks, not for months. No clouds pass slow and stately as ships over the roofs of these houses. With a metallic click, like that of a hammer tapping a nail, a black spot lands on the window, as if pulled there by magnetic force. Robert, still peering at the thermometer, flinches. The insect has a striated underside, 6 legs splaying outwards. Another appears at the other end of the window, then another, then another. "Those buggers are back," he murmurs. Greta comes to see, jamming on her glasses. Together they peer at them, transfixed. Swarms of red-backed aphids have in the past week been passing over the city. They mass in trees, on car windscreens. They catch in the hair of children coming home from school. They find their way into the mouths of those crazy enough to cycle in this heat. Their feet adhere to the sun-creamed limbs of people lying in their back gardens.
We've just heard Instructions for a Heat Wave by Maggie O'Farrell. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Bacon is founder of the Curvy Girl Lifestyle and creator of the 7-Step CCG Action Plan. She's a lifelong curvy girl who believes confidence is the building block of all success. Kat is an executive in the financial services industry, where she honed her marketing expertise and relationship skills into her second career as a Curvy Girl Lifestyle coach. She and her husband live in California. Today, we'll speak with her about her new book, Get More Dates Than Your Skinny Friends, A Curvy Girl's Guide to Conquering Men and the Competition. Kat's curvy girl dating advice is personal and to the point. She is living proof that dating success depends on what you do with yourself. Welcome, Kat. Thanks for joining us today on The Book Report.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I love the quote you selected to begin the book. It's by Gloria Steinem. Self-esteem isn't everything. It's just that there's nothing without it.
I love that quote. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Okay, so in the book, you share you've always been big-boned and you've struggled, like most of us, with losing weight. You've tried almost every diet plan, right?
Yes, I have. Including a diet I'm actually on right now.
Oh, all right. So tell us about the 7-Step CCG Action Plan and how you created it.
I created the 7-Step CCG Action Plan just to get people confident in themselves, because I think with curvy girls, they just don't have the self-esteem to actually get out there and be the best they can when it comes to dating. So I just kind of wanted to start the CCG Action Plan and just say, these are the things that I believe that you should do in order to feel great about yourself. So, you know, things like loving yourself and, you know, making sure that you're firing your worst critic and becoming your best publicist and things like that. So just steps that they can follow so they can help build their confidence and their self-esteem. So kind of more, instead of just saying you should become confident, I actually go through the steps of actually how to become confident.
Okay. How do you stop yourself from saying, I'll start dating after I lose 20 pounds?
Well, I know that's always hard, because I think a lot of curvy girls feel that way. They think, oh, you know, I'll put my online profile up after I lose 20 pounds and my pictures look better. And I think that it's really unfortunate there's so many wonderful curvy girls out there just kind of waiting to start their life. And so part of feeling confident is just loving yourself exactly the way you are and feeling comfortable in your skin. So a lot of the tips in my book kind of talk about just accepting and saying, yes, you know what, I am curvy. I might always be curvy. And I do talk about that as well in the book, is that I do believe that, you know, there's a couple different types of curvy girls, and one type of curvy girl has always been curvy. Like, just like me, I was born curvy. I will always be curvy. And that's okay. And I think that a lot of us always say, no, I want to be skinny before I start. But, you know, the reality is that for some of us, that's just not the case. And then for another group of women, you know, maybe they've gained weight because they've had a baby or they have some health issues. And for them as well, they're just kind of holding off and saying, hey, you know, I want to look better before I start. And, you know, they're just, their life is passing them by while all these great guys are going by and the skinny chicks are taking their guys. So, you know, we kind of talk in the book about, you know, how to just stop, love yourself the way that you are and just start taking action where you're at.
You know, I was very interested by your statement that the emphasis on having a stick-thin figure is actually female-driven. Talk about that.
That is absolutely true. I think that most women feel, oh, guys want a perfect body. And that's just not the case. I've, you know, read studies where, you know, men, there's a recent study from Cosmo, I believe, that says that, you know, that guys first look at face and then bust line and then hair and then body. So body is like four on the list for them. So just because you maybe you don't have a rockin' body, you can always play up your other features to attract the men. And again, there's a lot of guys that actually prefer heavier women. So there's guys that like the curves or they like bigger legs, and you know, and that's okay. And you have to go out there knowing that, hey, there's going to be a group of guys that you are going to fit perfectly for exactly the way you are.
And how do you, if you're attracted to a guy and he's not actually into curvy women, how do you work up the, you know, the confidence to go right back out there again?
I just think you have to have the mindset of saying next, and that not every guy is going to be, you know, your cup of tea, and vice versa. So if you're flirting with a guy, and in the book I talk about different ways to flirt, and if you're flirting and they're looking around you and they're not looking at you, it's okay. That means, okay, that's not the right one. And you just kind of have to have the attitude of next. And, you know, this is kind of a numbers game. When you're out there dating, it's okay to just say, okay, you know, I know I'm going to meet a lot of frogs before I meet my prince. And you just have to continue to move on, because eventually you will find that guy that looks at you and thinks, wow, you're perfect exactly the way that you are.
And how did you meet your prince?
Well, I was lucky. I actually lived next door to my husband growing up in high school, and then 20 years later, he found me on Facebook, and he messaged me, and I recognized him because he's bald now, and I was like, who are you? And he was like, I live next door to you, and he said, you know, can I give you a call tonight? And I almost said no, because he was living in Denver at the time, and I live in California, and I thought, no, this isn't going to go anywhere. Why am I wasting my time? But then I thought, okay, you know, I want to be in the place of saying yes. I want to take chances. And because that's kind of like what I talk about in the book, is kind of having a deal breakers list instead of having that perfect guy list. And I thought, okay, well, a guy being across the country is not on my deal breakers list, so I'll let him call me. What can be the harm? So he called me that night from Denver, and he said, hey, can I call you the next night? And then he called me the next night, and within a couple weeks, he came out for a visit, and then within a couple months, he moved out to California. So it was meant to be, and we've been together ever since. So,
well, it's great. Congratulations. Speaking of Facebook, what's your opinion of internet dating?
I absolutely love internet dating. So especially for curvy girls who are maybe insecure about going out to clubs and things like that, it's a perfect place to, you know, go on the internet. Obviously, you have to be smart about it, but you want to go on the internet. You want to make sure that you're making a profile that's interesting. I always encourage curvy girls to at least post one picture that's full body. You know, make it as attractive as you can make it. You know, I always say if your photographer holds the camera a little higher up and kind of comes down, then you're going to get more of a slimming appearance. But be as honest as you can in your profile. Be interesting and be yourself. And I think that the guys that are looking for you are going to be able to find you that way.
How have guys reacted to your book?
Actually, guys really like my book. I've had several read it. I actually had a married guy read my book and said how much that it helped him in his confidence. So he was, you know, he said, look, you know, I'm already married, but, you know, this really helped me put in perspective how I have insecurities about myself. And then I also had some single guys say, hey, it was great to read the book and to speak and realize what girls actually think about. And they were surprised that there's so many girls that are insecure about their bodies, because, you know, guys look over a lot more than girls. So girls are pickier with each other, and guys don't see all of the flaws. They kind of see you as a whole. So I think that's been interesting for a lot of guys to read the book.
Yeah, actually, after reading your book, I felt it was a great confidence builder no matter what the body type. I really enjoyed it. Where can folks buy your book?
They can buy my book at my website at getmoredatesthanyourskinnyfriends.com, or they can go on Amazon. And it's available in an actual book form and in the ebook form.
All right. So are you already working on a sequel?
I am, and my next book is called Get More Proposals Than Your Skinny Friend.
So closing the deal, in other words.
Exactly. So it kind of takes it. So now so the first book kind of gets them dating. So they're getting the dates. And then the second book kind of takes them from, okay, so now you've got your one guy. How do you then make that serious and turn that into a proposal?
All right. Well, Kat, I want to thank you a lot for joining us today. The book was really enjoyable. And as I say, for most everybody that needs a confidence boost, thanks a lot for joining us.
In Ellen Hildebrand's beautiful day, the Carmichaels and the Grahams have gathered on Nantucket for a wedding. Plans are being made according to the wishes of the bride's late mother, who left behind the notebook, specific instructions for every detail of her youngest daughter's future nuptials. Everything should be falling into place for the event, but as always, life intervenes. While the couple-to-be are very happy, their loved ones find their own lives crumbling. In the days leading up to the wedding, love will be questioned, scandals will arise, and hearts will be broken and healed. Therese Plummer narrates.
I can't stand the thought of giving Jenna away. She's my last one. Well, I guess technically Nick is my last one, but Nick might never get married. Nick Carmichael, brother of the bride. My sister has extremely hot friends. Margot, sister of the bride, maid of honor. Can I be honest? I really just want this weekend to be over. Thursday. Margot. They were on the ferry, the hulking white steamship that was properly named the Eagle, but which Margot had always thought of as Moby Dick, because that was what their mother used to call it. Every year when the Carmichael family drove their Ford Country Squire into the darkened hold of the boat, Beth used to say it was like being swallowed by a whale. She had found the ride on the steamship romantic, literary, and possibly also biblical. She would have been thinking of Jonah, right? But Margot had despised the ferry ride then, and she despised it even more now. The thick, swirling fumes from the engines made her queasy, as did the lurching motion. For this trip, Margot had taken the Dramamine that Jenna offered her in Hyannis. Really, with the 7,000 details of her wedding to triage, the fact that Jenna had remembered to pack pills for her sister's seasickness was astonishing. But that was Jenna for you. She was thoughtful, nearly to a fault. She was, Margot thought with no small amount of envy, exactly like their mother. For Jenna's sake, Margot pretended the Dramamine was working. She pulled down the brim of her straw hat against the hot July sun, which was blinding when reflected off the surface of the water. The last thing she wanted was to freckle right before the wedding. They were outside on the upper deck. Jenna and her best friend, Finn Sullivan Walker, were posing against the railing at the bow of the boat. Nantucket was just a smudge on the horizon. Even Christopher Columbus might not have said for sure there was land ahead, but Jenna was adamant that Margot take a picture of her and Finn with their blonde hair billowing around their faces as soon as Nantucket was visible in the background. Margot planted her feet at shoulder width to steady herself against the gentle and yet nefarious rocking of the boat and raised the camera. Her sister looked happy. She looked excited happy that this was the beginning of her wedding weekend, which was certain to be the most fun-filled and memorable weekend of her life. And she also looked contented happy because she was confident that marrying Stuart James Graham was her life's mission. Stuart was the one. Stuart had proposed to Jenna on a park bench across the street from Little Mines, the progressive, sustainable preschool where Jenna was the lead teacher, presenting her with a ring featuring Sri Lankan sapphires and ethically mined diamonds from Canada. Stuart was a banker who made money buying and selling money, but he knew the path to Jenna's heart. Since that day, Margot had cast herself as devil's advocate to Jenna's vision of a lifetime of happiness with Stuart. Marriage was the worst idea in all of civilization, Margot said. For two people to meet when they were young and decide to spend the rest of their lives together was unnatural, Margot said,
Because everyone knew that human beings changed as they got older. And what were the chances, honestly, what were the chances that two people would evolve in ways that were compatible?
That was Beautiful Day by Aaron Hildebrand. Book Report believes it's time for some rollicking fun, and Ladies' Night by Mary Kay Andrews is just the ticket. Grace Stanton's life takes a surprising turn when she catches her husband cheating. She torpedoes his sports car straight into the family swimming pool. As quick as you can say, not a good idea, Grace finds herself locked out of her palatial home and checking account. She's forced to move in with her widowed mom, who owns and lives above a rundown beach bar called The Sandbox. And then there are the court-mandated weekly divorce recovery therapy sessions with three other women and a guy for whom betrayal seems to be the only commonality. When their divorce coach starts to act suspiciously, the group decides to start having their own Wednesday ladies' night sessions at the Sandbox. The unanticipated bonds that develop lead the members of the group to try and find closure in ways they never imagined. Kathleen McInerney narrates.
Ben rested a hand lightly on her shoulder and studied the vignette. "Is that for tomorrow's Friday favorites post?" he asked. "Mm-hmm," Grace said. "I tried the palmetto fronds, and before that, a basket of seashells, and then some green mangoes, but I think the tomatoes work best, don't you?" He shrugged.
"I guess."
"What?" Grace studied his face, as always, craving his approval. "The tomatoes don't work for you?"
"They're nice, in an artsy-fartsy kind of way," he said.
She pushed a strand of light brown hair off her forehead and took a step back from the table. She'd spent an hour putting the table together, and she'd been fairly pleased with the effect she'd achieved. But Ben didn't like it. "Too country cutesy?" she asked, glancing at her husband. Ben's trained eyes missed nothing. He'd been in the ad business forever, and no detail was too small or too insignificant. It was why they made such a great team.
"It's your blog," he reminded her, "and your name is on it. I don't want business stuff to impinge on your editorial freedom, but..."
"But what? Come on, I'm a big girl. I can take it."
"The Aviento folk sent us a big crateful of pieces of their new fall line," Ben said, hesitating. "Treasures of Tuscany, the new pattern is called. It's for the giveaway you're doing on Monday. I was thinking maybe you could put the tomatoes in one of those bowls they sent."
Grace wrinkled her nose. "That is seriously the ugliest pottery I have ever seen, and it looks about as Italian as a can of Chef Boyardee."
"You don't have to set the whole table with it. Just maybe put some of the tomatoes in one of the bowls. They are spending a lot of money advertising with us now, and it would be good if they could see their product, you know."
"Stinking up my Friday favorites tablescapes," Grace said, finishing the sentence for him. "Did you promise them I would use it editorially? Tell me the truth, Ben."
"No," he said sharply. "I would never try to influence you that way. But would it hurt to maybe try a couple shots with one of the bowls or a plate?"
"I'll try it out. But if it looks as crappy as I think it will, I'm not going to run it, right? I mean, you promised when we monetized the blog we wouldn't be whoring me out by using the advertiser's product in a way that would compromise my aesthetic."
"It's your call," Ben said, picking up one of the tomatoes and examining it. "These are weird looking. What kind are they?"
"Don't know," Grace said, gently taking the tomato from him and replacing it on the table. "Jamie picked them up at the farmer's market."
"Kid's got a good eye,"
Ben said. He glanced back at the table.
"How long before you're done here?"
"Maybe an hour. I guess I'll try some shots with the Aviento stuff. Then I need to edit, and I've still got to actually write the piece." She glanced down at her watch. "Good Lord, it's after 6. I've been piddling around with this tabletop for hours now. Why didn't you say something?"
"Didn't want to interrupt the genius while she was at work," he said. But since you brought it up, is there any actual food to go on these pretty plates?
That was Ladies' Night by Mary Kay Andrews. In Dorothea Benton Frank's novel, Leslie Ann Green Carter is the last original wife among her husband Wesley's wildly successful Atlanta social set. His cronies have all traded in the mothers of their children for tanned and toned young Barbie brides. If losing the social life and close friends she adored wasn't painful enough, a series of setbacks shake her world. Leslie's had enough of playing the good wife to a husband who thinks he's doing her a favor by keeping her around. Now she's going to take some time for herself in the familiar comforts and beauty of Charleston, her hometown. In her brother's home, she'll rediscover her inner voice and reclaim her life. Robin Miles performs the book.
Welcome to St. Magnolia's Wounded Theater. At least that's what I called it. Within these slick walls reside Atlanta's pish-posh team of premier psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, and relationship counselors who specialize in the broken hearts, crushed egos of the privileged and renowned. Their lavish confessionals perched high above the city are, well, breathtaking. I was here because my husband Wesley insisted this was the only place he'd even consider receiving, as he was loath to say, therapy. And as it was on my first visit, the vast waiting area was packed. Just for the record, Wesley needed therapy. I absolutely did not. The circular reception area held a large round workstation of bird's eye maple. The conotops tops of deep brown granite were chiseled and polished. Behind them stood two young women who appeared to have fallen from the pages of Vogue magazine. Above them hung a chandelier worthy of an opera host that I imagined sailed right to America directly from the lips of the finest glassblowers of Murano. Every square foot of their offices was as beautiful as a session was insanely expensive, leaving me to wonder where exactly was this much heralded recession. "I'm here to see Dr. Katz," I said. "And you're Mrs. Carter?" "Thank you." She pecked around on what looked like a keyboard from the Starship Enterprise and smiled when she found my name among those on his appointment calendar. I was officially entered into the captain's log. "Please make yourself comfortable in the waiting area. There's bottled water." "Thanks." My heels clicked across the beige marble flooring that was shot with veins of black and gold. When the veins of gold caught a stream of afternoon light, they sparkled like the proverbial streets of paradise. Perhaps some people thought all this grandeur was a comfort. You know, they must be good at what they do if they can afford all this. Not me.
We've just heard a sample of The Last Original Wife by Dorothea Benton Frank. And now, readers, a book report tribute to an author whose delightful books kept us entertained and kept us coming back for more. Barbara Mertz, who you may know as Barbara Michaels or Elizabeth Peters, recently passed away at age 85. In her college days, Mertz, always fascinated by the pharaohs, pursued a doctorate in Egyptology. She wrote two scholarly books on ancient Egypt, but was unable to find employment in academia. Happily for us, she turned to fiction. I bet you're familiar with her parasol-toting Victorian pyramid explorer, Amelia Peabody. If not, you'll love this introduction. Author Paul Theroux once quipped, "Between Amelia Peabody and Indiana Jones, it's Amelia in Wit and Daring by a landslide." In Tomb of the Golden Bird, book 18 in the series, eminent Egyptologist Radcliffe Emerson, Amelia's husband, is convinced the tomb of King Tut lies somewhere in the Valley of the Kings. But having been banned forever from the East Valley, Emerson tries desperately to persuade Lord Carnarvon and Howard Carter to relinquish their digging rights. To no avail. The Emerson clan is forced to watch from the sidelines as Carter and Carnarvon discover the greatest Egyptian treasure of all times. Resolved to get their own excavation at a different site underway, Emerson and his son Ramses are lured into a deadly trap. Can Amelia protect her family? Let's listen to Barbara Rosenblatt's delightful performance.
Have you had any interesting encounters? Ramses asked, looking over the people taking tea on the terrace. They were the usual sort, well-dressed, well-groomed, and almost all white, if that word can be used to describe complexions that ranged from pimply pale to sunburned crimson. Lord and Lady Allenby stopped to say hello, I replied. He was most agreeable, but I understand why people refer to him as the bull. He has that set to his jaw.
He has to be forceful. As High Commissioner, he is under fire from the imperialists in the British government and the nationalists in Egypt. On the whole, I can only commend his efforts.
I did not want to talk politics. The subject was too depressing. There is your father, I said, late as usual. Ramses looked over his shoulder at the street. There was no mistaking Emerson. He is one of the finest-looking men I have ever beheld. Raven locks and eyes of a penetrating sapphire blue, a form as impressive as it had been when I first met him. He stood a head taller than those round him, and his booming voice was audible some distance away. He was employing it freely, greeting acquaintances in a mixture of English and Arabic, the latter liberally salted with the expletives that have given him the Egyptian sobriquet of Father of Curses. Egyptians had become accustomed to this habit and replied with broad grins to remarks such as, "How are you, Ibrahim, you old son of an incontinent camel?" My distinguished husband, the finest Egyptologist of this or any era, had earned the respect of the Egyptians with whom he had lived for so many years because he treated them as he did his fellow archaeologists. That is to say, he cursed all of them impartially when they did something that vexed him. It was not difficult to vex Emerson. Few people lived up to his rigid professional standards, and time had not mellowed his quick temper.
"He's got someone with him," said Ramses.
"Well, well," I said. "What a surprise." The individual who followed in Emerson's mighty wake was none other than Howard Carter. Perhaps I should explain the reason for my sarcasm, for such it was. Howard was one of our oldest friends, an archaeologist whose career had undergone several reversals and recoveries. He was presently employed by Lord Carnarvon to search for royal tombs in the Valley of the Kings. Searching for royal tombs in the Valley of the Kings was Emerson's great ambition, one he could not fulfill until Carnarvon gave up his concession. Rumour had it that his lordship was about to do so, having come to the conclusion, shared by most Egyptologists, that the valley had yielded all it ever would. Emerson did not share that conclusion. At the end of the previous season, he had admitted to me that he believed there was at least one more royal tomb to be found, that of the little-known king Tutankhamun. He had done his best, without actually lying, to conceal this belief from Howard. One of the reasons why we had come to Egypt so much earlier than was our custom was to discover what plans Howard and his patron had made for the coming season. One look at Emerson's expressive countenance told me what I wanted to know. Despite the heartiness of his vociferous greetings, his sapphire eyes were dull, his well-cut lips set in a downward curve. Carnarvon had not abandoned his concession.
That was The Tomb of the Golden Bird by Elizabeth Peters. Thanks for taking time from your holiday weekend to join us today. Need some additional suggestions for your final summer reads? Check my website, bookreportradio.com. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and the end of summer, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.